of policy and military leaders, but this is not enough. This is not enough. This is this can be indicative, suggestive of genocide. What has been conclusive for me is how this has reverberated both through policy documents, like, for example, the legal justification that Israel has given, how it has reverberated, been internalized, and resulted in the conduct of the troops on the ground, but also patterns.
Right. But if you could give me some specific examples of both the language that you're referring to and how it's reverberated that makes you get to this conclusion.
Yeah. First of all, I've looked at the acts committed. How did we get to 70 to 30, over 30,000 people killed, 70% of whom have always been women and children? And we cannot assume, as the government has, as the military, the Israeli occupation forces have done, that those are all militants. But there is the killing, there is the heightened blockade, which has caused starvation, the destruction of the hospitals. But as you asked me for this language, I talked about humanitarian camouflage to refer to the distortions of IHL that Israel has proposed since the 8th of October. Because in fact, Israel has never denied the commission of the acts. It has justified those as IHL abiding, both in its statements and in front of the International Court of Justice during the proceedings initiated by South Africa. So, for example, human shields, warnings, evacuation, safe zones, military objectives, all this jargon has been used to justify military assaults and military operations. But if we look at the conduct that has been undertaken, it's clear that each action justified as through the terms I used reveals that the full distortion of the very protection function that IHL carries. Because there has been a generalization of what can be considered human shields. The use of human shields is prohibited. But it's clear that Israel has assumed, like a blanket justification, that the civilians in Gaza wear human shields. Or, for example, let me give you this example, how it is the concept of proportionality has been completely capsized. The bombing of Jabalia, of the Jabalia refugee camp, to kill one commander, one Hamas commander, and never we received evidence of that. But let's assume that there was one commander. Hundreds of people were killed and injured, including hostages. How proportionate can it be?
Right. Your report has been met with serious opposition. In a statement, the Israeli embassy in Geneva says the report brings shame on the Human Rights Council and that it utterly rejects the report. And when the U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller was asked about it, he said this.
First, we have, for a longstanding period of time, opposed the mandate of this special rapporteur, which we believe is not productive. And when it comes to the individual who holds that position, I can't help but note a history of anti-Semitic comments that she has made that have been reported.
She made anti-Semitic comments.
So how do you respond to that?
Look, first of all, I want to clarify. I feel that the report has been met with by a sense of relief among the human rights community and also civil society who has been watching and asking what was happening in Gaza, because this is a genocide, as the South African legal team said, which has been televised by its own, and thanks to the its own victims and the soldiers, I would say. But so, yes, of course, there was a criticism of Israel, and I was appalled by the words that the U.S. spokesperson used. It's so irresponsible, because it's true, I've criticized the state of Israel for its policies. Is it that outrageous to expect that Israel behaves in line with international law? Is this anti-Semitic? And I find it really discouraging, because this man has no idea of the pressure that has been put on me just before delivering, just for serving the Human Rights Council, and also for free, as I've been asked. And there is a lot of pressure on me because of that. So he's not making my life easier.
Now, you made a number of recommendations in your report, including an arms embargo on Israel, an investigation, and an international protective presence in Gaza. But I have to ask if this is an exercise in futility. I mean, we saw the UN Security Council pass a resolution demanding a ceasefire and the release of hostages. Both of those things haven't happened. Do you expect international backing for these recommendations?
There must be. There must be, because the reason why we face the most significant failure of multilateralism, of international law and international protection systems is because of the opposition. And I'm sorry to say that, but this is the opposition made by the United States. The United States are clear part and parcel of what's happening in Gaza. In the same message the US spokesperson used to smear me, he said that Israel is complying with international humanitarian law. I mean, How can this be credible when it's clear that there are violations through and through? Think so just of starvation, causing starvation. How can it be legal?
Francesca Albanese is the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Thank you for your time and for being on the program.
Thank you, Leila. Bye.
For more coverage of this war and differing views and analysis of what is happening, go to npr.org/Mideast Updates.
Major changes are coming to how the U.S. government asks about your race and ethnicity. And supporters say these changes could improve the accuracy of statistics about Latinos and people of Middle Eastern or North African descent. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports.
Guillermo Creamer says one of those changes is going to solve a conundrum. On federal government forms, he answers, yes, he identifies as Latino, which the government considers to be an ethnicity. And then he has to answer,
what's your race? I genuinely don't ever know what to answer.
You see the boxes and none of them quite fit for you.
No, because to me, you know, being Latino, that's all encompassing for me.
Creamer will soon be able to answer a new combined question that asks about a person's race and or ethnicity. And the checkboxes under it include Hispanic or Latino. The White House's Office of Management and Budget has released an example.
I sent it around to my parents and other members of my family, and I was like, hey, like, finally, like, there's more than just the other for us.
And there will be a completely new checkbox for Middle Eastern or North African.
It is progress. It is progress.
Maya Berry is the executive director of the Arab American Institute, which for more than three decades has been campaigning for this box and to change what research suggests to be an outdated policy for racially categorizing people with roots in the Middle East or North Africa, or MENA.
Yes, no longer rendered by definition in terms of formal federal policy as exclusively white. The point is, folks can self-identify with any racial category they feel comfortable with.
Still, Barry says she is concerned that the government's new definition for Middle Eastern or North African is not inclusive enough of people who are of MENA descent and identify with Black diaspora communities. And she's worried that can affect the data that'll be used to redraw voting districts, enforce civil rights, and guide policymaking and research across the country. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning and happy Friday. It is 8:19. Glad you're along with us this morning. And because it's a Friday, Wisconsin Life is coming up later this hour. We do it each and every Friday here on the show. Today we're going to hear from a woman who has taken on multiple caretaking roles in her life. It's part of a series we're airing this month on women in southern Wisconsin. That story is about 25 minutes away. Plus, we'll hear about Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich, who was detained in Russia a year ago today. That's all ahead on WPR.
PBS Wisconsin Education and the Wisconsin School Music Association have partnered with music educators to create ReSound, Songs of Wisconsin, a free collection of classroom media resources featuring contemporary Wisconsin musicians. The collection is designed to help general music educators and learners explore the connections between music, culture, identity, and emotion. Access lesson plans and more. Visit pbswisconsineducation.org.
Support for WPR comes from Overture Center for the Arts with the Changemaker Speaker Series, Inside Secrets of the Whales. Underwater photographer Brian Scarry shares secrets of five whale species, April 23rd. Overture.org.
Support comes from Offsite, providing co-managed and fully managed IT solutions to help their clients navigate the complexity of running operations across multiple data centers, cloud platforms, and software applications. Visit off-site.com/radio.
Public Radio. In weather, little windy across the state today, but overall not too bad, with sunshine and high temperatures in the 30s and 40s in the north and 40s and 50s in the south. Things are expected to stay dry during the daytime as well. A good chance for a little bit of some rain in southern Wisconsin overnight into tomorrow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Schwab, with Schwab investing themes like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, or pet passion. Over 40 themes to invest in. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Debbie Elliott. Sheryl Crow lied to us. Back in 2019, she put out an album, and she told All Things Considered that it would be her last.
We can't expect particularly young people to listen to albums from top to bottom. It's almost a dying art form.
And what's Sheryl Crow doing today? Well, she's releasing a new album. Her new record is called Evolution. So, of course, we needed her to come back to clarify.
I know. I can't count on what's going to come out of my mouth next. However, that being said, I didn't intend to put out an entire full-length album. It still feels like a playlist of new songs. So that's what I'm going to call it, a playlist of new songs by Sheryl Crow. How's that?
Okay. So what was the inspiration for the songs?
It really started off with this in-depth conversation about AI and what that's going to mean, not only for artists, but what it's going to mean for our humanity. I'm raising two young boys, they're teenagers, and I just found with, you know, I think it was the advent of the Beatles using John Lennon, and then shortly after that, George Carlin being used with a new comedy routine that somebody wrote and used his likeness. It felt very, very dangerous and very daunting to me as an artist to know that my voice can be inserted into someone else's work and that a program can write a Sheryl Crow song. And it's really about truth and about how do we discern what the truth is anymore? And are we even interested in the truth? And that's where, as a mom who has lived through most of her life without technology, this is where mom and artist intersect. And I found that I was just writing, I mean, literally just an artistic download that culminated with me putting out these new songs.
Turned on the radio and there it was, a song that sounded like something I wrote. The voice voice and melody were hauntingly so familiar that I thought it was a joke.
And I feel like you're also maybe making some observations about the particular challenges of our time beyond AI, in the sense that some of the very inventions and technologies that have the potential to make our lives better are really having the opposite effect, right? For instance, the song Broken Record seems to be written from the perspective of someone who's really fed up with social media, right?
Anger sucks, but at least your brand's trending. Dude, you must get tired. Well, we were buds, but now I'm unfriending. That's not how I'm wired.
That song was really in response to the hate that I got from speaking up about the Covenant shooting, which was right down the street from us. And
in Nashville.
In Nashville, yes. I think we've gotten away, because of texting and social media, we've gotten away from this idea of empathy, that we have to remember that the words we say, the things that we say, whether you know a person or you don't, can be hurtful. And all things should be based in intention. You know, my intention is something as simple as gun control isn't for the government to come in and take away people's guns. My intention is to try and find a way to make our kids safer. And instead of acknowledging intention, there's just like a lot of shut the F up and sing, and I mean, just some really ugly things. And so the song really is just, it is directed from something my mom told me when I was a kid, which is it's just as easy to be nice as it is to be a jerk.
I want to say that I really enjoyed the song Love Life, and I want to listen to it for a little bit.
When we were young, we had some strawberry wine. Me and my friend would cross the Tennessee line. Fake IDs and some neon lights. Get us out on the floor and we dance all night.
So this song reminds me a little bit of my youth growing up in Memphis, Tennessee, right?
Oh my goodness.
And also of where I am in my life right now. I think I'm close to the same age you are, and I'm really trying to embrace all that is good and precious in life, you know?
Yes.
And this song speaks to that.
There's so many times when I think I'm going to remember this moment. In fact, last night I was playing basketball with my kids, and the basketball bounced off the wall, came back and hit me right in the head. And we all were like, we were like cockroaches on our backs. We were laughing so hard. And I remember thinking, I'm going to look back on this moment. And I think you do get to a certain point in your life, and it's like the song says, we'll be looking back at right now someday. You do get to an age where you start trying to catalog all the moments that you want to remember, you know, because when you're young, your whole life is in front of you and you don't, you think it's just never going to end. And then as you get older, you realize that time flies at warp speed, you know,
yep.
And especially when you're raising kids and you start counting summers, like how many more summers do I have with my kids? And that's really what the song is about. It's just about stopping for a moment and acknowledging that moment and being in it.
I love this life. Baby, we'll be talking back right now someday, yeah.
That's Sheryl Crow. Her unexpected new album is called Evolution. By the way, I guess you're probably done with predicting which album will be your last now.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. I think I've evolved.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Debbie.
Let me hear you sing it, baby.
This is NPR News.
As a cargo ship bore down on Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge early Tuesday morning, first responders scrambled to make sense of the scene.
Cat 4, I think everybody that was on that bridge is in the water, sir.
I'm Elsa Chang, the Baltimore Bridge collapse, from the point of view of first responders, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30, today on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Good morning. Thanks so much for being here for Morning Edition on this Friday here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29. News from NPR and WPR begins in just seconds.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Large cranes are being brought into Maryland to begin removing steel and concrete from the Patapsco River in Baltimore. That's where a container ship struck a support on the Francis Scott Key Bridge earlier this week, causing much of the bridge to collapse. Governor Wes Moore says it could take months to remove the debris. The bodies of four maintenance workers who were on the bridge at the time have yet to be recovered. The bodies of two others were found. The nearly 1,000-foot ship, the Dolly, remains in the river. With the Port of Baltimore closed to ship traffic indefinitely, other East Coast ports are picking up additional cargo. Benjamin Payne with Georgia Public Broadcasting says that includes the port of Savannah.
Savannah is home to the second busiest container port along the eastern seaboard, behind only the port of New York and New Jersey. Mayor Van Johnson assured Georgians this week that cargo ships passing beneath the bridge along the Savannah River are escorted by local captains who know the ins and outs of the waterway.
I think our residents can feel safe again. I've been on these ships with these river pilots. They navigate a much narrower waterway than what is in Baltimore, and they do it with skill and precision.
Unlike the Key Bridge in Baltimore, the support columns for Savannah's bridge are located off to the shore rather than within the waters of the shipping channel. For NPR News, I'm Benjamin Payne in Savannah, Georgia.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Negotiations between the Packers and the city of Green Bay to extend the lease for Lambeau Field have stalled. The Packers' lease runs through 2033, with options to extend it for another decade. The Packers reached out to the city more than a year ago seeking a long-term extension. But both sides have not been able to reach a mutually beneficial agreement, and the city has paused those discussions. Aaron Popke is the team's director of public affairs.
The Packers feel we're waiting for the city to give the team a counterproposal. We've made three written proposals, have not received a counterproposal.
Because negotiations have stalled, the Packers have paused $80 million worth of stadium renovations that were set to take place this summer. A massive search effort with dozens of drones did not turn up any sign of a missing three-year-old boy near Two Rivers. Police departments from across the state coordinated for this Thursday search using nearly 70 teams of drone operators to search for Elijah Vu. Elijah has been missing since February 20th. Both his mother and her boyfriend remain jailed on child neglect charges, but nobody has been officially charged in the child's disappearance. The Two Rivers Police Department says it has also conducted a separate search last week with assistance from the Department of Natural Resources, local farmers, and local businesses. Police say they're continuing to search for Elijah while also, quote, investigating the circumstances regarding his disappearance. A Wisconsin congressman who's resigning next month has apparently found a new job. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports Mike Gallagher has taken a job with Planter. That's an internet security and data analytics company. Gallagher's a Green Bay Republican who announced that he was leaving Congress on April 19th after he voted against impeaching President Joe Biden's Homeland Security Secretary. Gallagher has chaired the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party and has been a leading critic of the Chinese-owned social media app TikTok. The House has passed his bill to force the Chinese-based ownership group to sell its stake in TikTok or be banned in the United States. Gallagher has represented the Green Bay District in Congress since 2017. In weather, a bit windy today, sunshine as well, with highs in the 30s and 40s in the north and 40s and 50s in the south. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, streaming the Agatha Christie collection, including series like Poirot, Why Didn't They Ask Evans, and new original mystery, Murder is Easy. The Agatha Christie collection, streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. And from Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 42 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide.
Learn more at jonesday.com. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Debbie Elliott in Orange Beach, Alabama. 1 year ago today, Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was detained in Russia on suspicion of espionage. He remains in custody. He denies the charges, and the U.S. government says he's been wrongfully detained. Emma Tucker is editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal.
He was in court earlier this week. Generally speaking, we don't have direct contact with him. Any contact we have is via letters. He's a prolific letter writer. But in terms of his well-being, he's holding up okay. But, you know, at the end of the day, he's been in prison for a year when he shouldn't be there. It's a complete outrage. And, you know, it's time for him to come home.
Is there any indication that he will be put on trial anytime soon?
Well, it's very hard to tell. I mean, what's happened is since he was detained, we've had this cycle of he shows up in court and his pretrial detention gets extended. We challenge that extension. We lose the appeal. And then he reappears in court 3 months later. This has happened 5 times now. So I think under Russian so-called law, they're allowed to hold somebody for a year in pretrial detention. But when there are special circumstances, they can extend it. And that's what's happened here.
The latest ruling has this extended until June.
Correct.
Putin has said he's open to the idea of some sort of a prisoner swap with the U.S. involving Gershkovich. Has there been any movement in that direction that you're aware of?
No, I think it's a complicated process with different governments, different actors involved. I mean, when Putin started talking about the possibility of a prisoner swap, I think everybody did feel a little bit more optimistic. But at the moment, it feels like there's not much movement on that front at all. So we can only hope.
Do you think the Biden administration is doing all it should to get Evan Gershkovich home?
The Biden administration has been pretty relentless in its efforts to get Paul and Evan out. You know, obviously, it's a year. It's very, very frustrating. But I'm confident that they're doing everything they can.
You're talking about Paul Whelan, who is also accused of espionage and jailed in Russia. You had just joined the Wall Street Journal as its editor-in-chief a few months before Evan's detainment. If it's not too difficult for you, I wonder if you might share your memories of a year ago when you first learned that he had been detained.
Well, I'll never forget the day because my managing editor mentioned to me at the end of a meeting about something else. She said, oh, by the way, one of our reporters in Russia has missed his security check-in. So we have a protocol for all our reporters in dangerous parts of the world. They have to check in 3 times a day. Now, at that point, I did think, well, you know, maybe his phone's run out of battery. Maybe he has no Wi-Fi. I wasn't too alarmed, but it triggered sort of unhappy memories of a similar incident we'd had when I was in London at the Times of London, when 2 reporters got kidnapped in Syria. The same sort of thing unfolded. Anyway, I put it out of my mind. And then a few hours later, the managing editor, I saw her coming back towards my office and I just knew she was coming to tell me that he'd missed his second check-in. And at that point, she was in touch with his family and we were beginning to get seriously worried. I went home. I said, I'll leave my phone on. Only ring me if it's bad news. And my phone rang at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I remember waking up and thinking, oh God, and it was bad news.
How do you, as a news executive, balance the need to cover the world with the need to keep your reporters safe?
That is such a good and important question. It's becoming harder and harder for reporters to do their job around the world. And news organizations like ours are getting worryingly adept at covering stories from outside countries. So as it stands, we only have 1 reporter in Russia and he is in prison. All our Russia coverage is done from outside Russia. We have to prioritize our journalists' safety. And that does mean having to make some very difficult decisions about when to go into a country and when not to. And we will never, ever step away from our commitment as a big media brand to cover stories from the ground. Where we can do that, we will remain committed to doing it. But as I say, we have to put our reporters' safety first.
Emma Tucker is editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal. Today marks 1 year since their reporter, Evan Gershkovich, was detained by Russia, where he remains. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Now to London. which holds a famous race on the River Thames this weekend. Thousands of spectators will line the banks to watch the annual event. But there's more to worry about than who will win, as NPR's Lauren Freyer explains.
And Oxford Arkon, they're throwing everything at this year. It's going to be a narrow victory for Cambridge.
The University Boat Race is the biggest rowing event on the River Thames, pitting Oxford against Cambridge.
And again, all smiles.
Fantastic race.
The tradition is for the winning team to splash into the water at the finish line. But this year, they're being urged not to because of dangerously high levels of E. coli bacteria. This is not a fluke of nature.
Sewage spills by water companies into rivers and seas in England.
Government data out this week show raw sewage spills doubled here last year. Charities have cropped up across the UK with names like Surfers Against Sewage. Oxford's rowing coach calls pollution in the Thames, where his team is competing this weekend, a national disgrace. Environmentalists say this began back in 1989.
Where is it? Water privatisation, I believe, will go very successfully indeed.
When then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher started privatising the UK's public utilities. The country's water companies are now owned in part by the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, a Hong Kong billionaire, and US investors. Over the years, they've extracted tens of billions in dividends while skimping on improvements to Victorian-era sewage pipes. And in the case of Thames Water, the country's biggest water company, serving a quarter of UK households, they ran the company into the ground. Its chief executive, Chris Weston, told local TV that Thames Water is now broke and has to get money from somewhere. So
the plans that we have put forward, which are very much in accordance with what customers are asking us to do, require an investment of around £20 billion, and that would result in a bill rise of around 40%.
A 40% rise in customers' bills during the country's worst cost of living crisis since World War II. Fergal Sharkey is a former punk rock singer who's become one of the UK's most prominent clean water activists, and he is irate, telling the BBC,
"We have already provided all of the funding to water companies for 33 years for them to build a properly functioning sewage system. The question we should be asking is, where's our money gone? What has happened to it? And when can we get a refund?"
The country's biggest water utility may have to be nationalised in the coming weeks. And this weekend, instead of a victory splash after their race in the River Thames, rowers are being asked to visit a disinfecting station at the finish line. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:42 on this Friday. A shame when pollution ruin something great like that. I remember growing up near Lake Michigan and getting excited to go to the beach with my parents, and then all of a sudden you get there and there's the same thing, E. coli in the water, and you weren't able to go. Still to come this hour here on the program, plenty more to get to. We're going to hear about a Nigerian ballet dancer who's featured in a new Disney Plus documentary. That's still on the way on WPR.
There are many ways to support the lifelong learning you enjoy on Wisconsin Public Radio. One way is to donate stock. It's tax efficient because you won't pay capital gains on the increase, and your investment will support the information, connection, and inspiration you enjoy from WPR programs. Talk to your broker or find out more at wpr.org/stock.
Support for WPR comes from Overture Center for the Arts, with The Kite Runner, based on the novel following one man's journey to confront his past and find redemption. May 24th through the 26th. Tickets at overture.org.
Support for WGTD's local news and public affairs commitment comes from Casey Family Options, a tradition of trust. For more information, including how to get started in pre-planning, visit caseyfamilyoptions.com or call 262-653-0667.
On Wisconsin Public Radio at 8:44, here's a look at what's happening in news. Four people remain missing in the Patapsco River following the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Two people were rescued alive earlier this week, and the bodies of two people who died were also recovered. Some ships remain stuck in the port of Baltimore while crews inspect the wreckage and search for the bodies of the other people who died. It has been 1 year since Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich was detained in Russia. As of now, he remains in custody. Governor Tony Evers announced yesterday that Wisconsin Department of Revenue Secretary Peter Barca is stepping down. His retirement is effective April 9th. And negotiations between the Packers and the city of Green Bay to extend the lease for Lambeau Field have stalled. More news at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Schwab, with Schwab investing themes like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, or pet passion. Over 40 themes to invest in. Learn more at schwab.com. From the law firm Cooley LLP, with offices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world where innovation meets the law. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with a story about a Madison business owner. It's part of a series we're airing this month on women in southern Wisconsin in partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
Shadeira Kilfoy Flores of Madison says she's often felt like a caretaker.
Well, I'm a mom. I'm a community member of a number of different communities.
That includes working with young people in Madison.
There's a lot of mommying that I do behind closed doors, mostly to LGBTQ, Black and brown youth who, for whatever reason, may not have supportive parents at home.
Plus, you can add artist, garden organizer, and chef to that resume. She told me about this as part of a storytelling partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. Kilfoy Flores has always been politically active, but there was one incident in Madison that changed everything for her.
Yeah, it's a hard one. My neighbor was killed by a police officer. And he wasn't just a neighbor. He was a family friend. He was a friend of my daughter's. He was a son of friends of mine.
That friend was Tony Robinson Jr., the 19-year-old shot and killed by a Madison police officer in 2015.
And it's been very, very hard to see the snowball of damage that his death has created.
Robinson's death sparked widespread demonstrations in the city. The Dane County District Attorney did not press charges against police officer Matt Kenny, who fatally shot Robinson. The family has worked for years to try to change that. Kilfoy Flores and her daughter, Serena Flores, channeled their grief by participating in the protests. Then, Serena got arrested at a demonstration outside her high school.
You know, she cried about the loss of freedom and that she had never felt so degraded and scared all at the same time. And I don't know that you ever heal from having your freedom taken away.
The charges against her daughter were later dropped. But this moment, paired with the shooting, made Kilfoy Flores want to do more. So she joined Madison's Police Civilian Oversight Board, the first of its kind in the state.
But the biggest difference is that Madison now has our very first independent police monitor.
The board works with that monitor and makes recommendations around police use of force and discipline. Kilfoy Flores is now the chair, and one of her goals is to create a safer community for civilians and officers.
I'm hoping that this can be a sustainable tool for accountability, but also for creating a bridge for community to be able to have more input in how we're being policed as well.
Kilfoy Flores has big goals. Once her time with the Police Oversight Board is up, she'd like to focus her attention on creating local, state, and federal legislation surrounding police accountability. And in the meantime, she hopes to encourage others to stand up for the issues they believe in.
Be the change that you want to see. If you see that something needs to happen, sometimes you got to make it happen yourself. We cannot always depend on others making the changes that we want. Sometimes you got to get off your duff and make it happen.
Shadeira Kilfoy Flores told us her story as part of a partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. We've partnered with the organization to share stories of women who live in southern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the weekly 90-minute-long online educational series to teach skills for how to take care of yourself while caring for a loved one is coming up from the Kenosha County ADRC. Begins the week of March 13th. Call 262-605-6646.
WPR.org.
It's morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, the Marquette Golden Eagles men's basketball team will play tonight in the Sweet 16. That one is set to start right around 6 o'clock. And the Milwaukee Brewers play their first game of the season this afternoon. That starts at 12:40. In weather, sunshine across the state today, highs in the 30s and 40s in the north, and 40s and 50s in the south. Things are expected to stay dry during the daytime today, but we could see rain overnight. It's WPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Debbie Elliott. In the first summer of the COVID-19 pandemic, the world was captivated by a viral video from Nigeria. In a concrete courtyard, a slim 11-year-old boy in a black tank top and multicolored shorts twirls and leaps gracefully in the pouring rain. Anthony Madu was doing what he loves most, dancing ballet. The video attracted the attention of Elmhurst Ballet School, a prestigious academy in Birmingham, England, which offered Anthony a scholarship. The story also captivated two filmmakers who followed Anthony's journey for a documentary called Madu, out today on Disney+.
People think that it's not for boys. It's my dream, and I have to follow it.
It's something that one has to embrace, accept. Oh, I put a shift.
Hi, Mr. Madu. We wanted to talk to you about Anthony, your son. He had so much raw talent that we are interested in at the school.
You must be very proud.
I'm very proud of him. I can't believe that I'm going to be schooling in England for 7 years.
I spoke to Madu, who's now 14, and the film's directors, Matt Ogens and Kachi Benson. I began by asking Madu what inspired him to learn ballet.
It kind of like all started when I was 5. I loved moving and dancing, and I told my mom that I wanted to dance, but at that time there wasn't any dance school around. After that, my mom found a ballet school that I could go to, and I started, yeah.
Director Matt Ogens, how did you find the story?
I always lead with curiosity and love character-driven stories that have universal human themes that we can all relate to. One of our producers just sent me this clip of, at the time, this 11-year-old boy doing ballet in the rain. And that video, as we know, went viral. And I was just struck by his confidence and his passion. And I dug into the internet and the social media world and found him. And I think within a few days or maybe a week, I was on a FaceTime with him and his family. And that's how the journey began.
Anthony, the story of this film is you and your family's decision to leave your home in Nigeria and move to the UK in order to go to a ballet school. How did you come to decide that was the right thing to do?
Well, because dancing was always something I wanted to do. And getting offered a place at Elmhurst Ballet School meant that I was able to follow my dreams even further. And I had the support of my mum and my family as well.
So Kachi, this is just a beautifully shot film. There are these lovely scenes of Anthony dancing. There are the street scenes in Nigeria. It almost feels more like a movie than it does a documentary. Was that an intended effect?
Everything about this particular film was very intentional. There's not a lot of talking heads or interviews, even though we shot quite a bit. But by the time we got into post and we looked at all the footage, we realized that there was so much that was happening in the moment that we really didn't need to use any interviews as a crutch to propel the story forward.
Anthony, you talked about some difficult things at times in this film. You were talked about being bullied in Nigeria for choosing to be a dancer, right? But it seems like you made some new close friendships once you got to England. How do you think your life changed after you started in the school in England?
My life changed in terms of being able to do what I want to do without having other people like tease me about it. Because at Elmhurst Valley School, we've got, everyone shares the same dreams and passion. We all just kind of, like, pretty much work together and not tease other people about it and stuff. And I think that has been a really, really good change for me.
There's a scene in the film I want to talk a little bit about that I found to be very lovely. It's where you go to see the Nutcracker and you're able to speak with a principal dancer afterward.
Come on, let's go center stage. So when you're at school and you're performing and your teachers are telling you to look out and beyond, imagine this, yeah?
Yeah.
Imagine this.
What was that moment like for you?
It was great because being on stage with a principal ballet dancer, it isn't something that happens all the time. And seeing what it feels like being on stage dancing with a lot of people, it felt amazing.
Matt and Kachi, you know, Anthony is an adolescent. That's a really difficult time in life. Did you all have conversations about, you know, following him and being sensitive that he was young and going to be alone and away from his family? I mean, how did you sort of address that?
We took our time to be very sensitive to Anthony's emotions, right? You know, there would be some times where maybe, you know, he doesn't feel like speaking, or he doesn't feel like, and we know when to pull back and sit this one out. And there was also a lot of after filming conversations. So in the heat of the moment, we've captured it, but, you know, we would always catch up afterwards and try to get to understand, okay, what's going on? How are you feeling? Is everything okay? But I think in the end, we respected, you know, his emotions, the boundaries that were set, and walked within those boundaries to still create something that, you know, we have all come to see that is beautiful and tells an inspiring story.
Anthony, what are you doing now? How have your dreams for the future changed since you arrived in England?
So now I'm still dancing. I'm still at Elmhurst Valley School, but I just kind of like want to keep improving on my dance and every other part of my life and get better at a lot of things and find new things. Yeah.
Well, the documentary is called Madhu and it's out on Disney Plus now. It features Anthony Madhu, directed by Matt Ogens and Kachi Benson. Thanks to all three of you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm Debbie Elliott.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Alex Crow. And that'll do it for Morning Edition on this Friday here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Appreciate you tuning in. Thanks for being here. And as always, thanks to John Davis for helping to bring us the news. If you missed any part of the news or you want to listen back to it, you can always find it on our daily news podcast, Wisconsin Today. You'll find that wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for WPR comes from All Energy Solar.
dedicated to offering advice on available government and utility solar incentives for property owners who want to make the switch to solar energy. More at allenergysolar.com.
Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity dedicated to keeping local resources local by encouraging families to begin tax-advantaged giving, strengthening nonprofits, and improving lives. Visit KenoshaFoundation.org.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.